So, be familiar with it. I know Brian has. I've got a lawyer here, so I gotta watch what I'm saying.
No, you don't. I'm not gonna. You're sure you know more than I do about it.
So it's a judicially created principle. And essentially what that means is it's not a statute, it's not a law. It's basically been created in the courts over the past 150 years. So an established precedent. And it's been traditionally applied to things like tidelands, rivers, wildlife, and navigable waterways, and successfully in most cases. One of the first cases was in 1850, and the Supreme Court stopped the city of Chicago from selling off the shore of Lake Michigan to private interests because they found that the shoreline itself was too important to be privatized, and it was a natural resource that needed to be kept for public benefit. So there's several cases that came after that. Maybe, I don't know if Brian would be familiar with some of them. But that kind of laid the groundwork for essentially what came out of it was that it holds that any natural resource that's vital to public welfare and human survival must be protected and managed in trust for the people and the citizens of the country or the state. An example you guys might be familiar with is the Montana Stream Access Law. Anybody know about that? Any fisher people here? Got a visitor. So if you guys aren't familiar with it, it's based on the public trust to a large degree. It basically allows any citizen to access riverways, river banks, and so forth, regardless of who owns their property, which the stream runs through. And this was, the public trust was used as the foundation for this. They basically said, this is too valuable to be privatized. It needs to be kept for public benefit. So a small example, and the public trust doctrine has, up until this point, been pretty narrowly applied like that in the courts. But, and I'll get to later, there's no reason why it can't be expanded outward to include a lot more than just rivers and tidelands. So basically creating duties and responsibilities for government to prioritize the public interest. So any land use decision being made, any permitting, any kind of land sale project, so forth, if it's filtered through a public trust, it's not only legally enforceable, but it prioritizes the public trust, the public interest in natural values before economic interests and private interests. It's been rarely used expansively, but there's a couple of instances, and one I'll get to later that's pretty exciting. But in the state of Pennsylvania, recently a law that was passed by the state legislature, so it was law, was thrown out by the state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania because it violated the public trust in terms of putting oil and gas exploration over water quality, forest health, so on and so forth. So it does work in small cases. This is usually on the state level. That was just my brief spiel of the public trust, but I'm gonna go through some of the pros and some of the cons real quick, and then maybe you guys can add some or comment. So the first big pro for me is that it has the force of law behind it. It doesn't matter if the government wants to keep dragging their feet, if corporations want to keep bribing our government, so on and so forth. The court hands down a decision, says you must do this. They're not going to tell them how to do it, but they're going to have to do it. It's monitored by the courts. It can be citizen driven, and I like that a lot. I think it can marry activism with environmental theory and environmental value. And what I mean by that is that what determines the public interest is largely up to us. That's a very general statement, and that can be expanded upon, which I go further. But the idea that it's democratic and that you go directly to a court, you don't have to deal with a representative or a senator whose, again, pockets are lined by various interests. You could appeal directly to the court as a citizen and make a claim that this is in the public interest or the public welfare. This must be stopped or something to that effect. As I said earlier, it obligates governments. So this is, since it does have legal force, it's, again, you don't have a politician paying lip service to something and then doing nothing about it. It obligates them to act. And one of my favorite things about it too is it's already established, so we don't need to create something from scratch here. I love philosophy, but part of me kind of realized at some point that sitting around thinking and coming up with these novel theories about value isn't gonna cut it for the very urgent situation that we're in. So I like the fact that we've had this tradition that's already here, hasn't been expanded upon yet, but there's nothing that prevents us from doing so. So those are the pros. Some of the cons, probably the first most obvious one is it can be threatening to private property owners and to industry. And they are stakeholders. I don't mean to sound like I'm completely anti both of those, but they would definitely face some repercussions if this were to be implemented on a larger scale. And on that note, it can create an unfair burden on those stakeholders. So a farmer in, you know, here in the valley or something wants to undertake some kind of project on her land, and maybe that degrades water quality, maybe it has other impacts downstream. If the public trust was in place, she may be prevented from doing so, and may lose out in some ways, whereas somebody in a city who lives in the city may not have as much to risk or much on the line. And then, of course, more litigation. Litigation is pretty divisive. Brian, I'm sure you know about that. And as you guys have seen with wolves and grizzly bears and all kinds of other stuff, it gets people pretty upset. So that's not a prospect that I think a lot of people might have a stomach for. And I think from philosophically, and this is something I struggle with the public trust, is that it uses economic language. So he says assets, ownership, and using the term trust in a financial context. And to that end, I get the primary issue is that where are the non-human interests here when we're talking about public welfare, public interests, so on and so forth. It's a problem. It's a problem for me, but I think if we can incorporate that into, we bring the world into us, that may seem still quite human-centered, but at least we're wrapping our arms around it wider, if that makes sense. So, I guess another problem is that it's determined by judges, so it's up to a judge. We can't lobby a judge like we can lobby a congressman or a congresswoman. And as Brian and I were just talking about, the judiciary is not looking great these days, and it's getting filled with people who probably won't be sympathetic to this theory. So that's about it. I would ask that maybe you guys think about what it would look like to expand this out and what things it might apply to. And I'll get to that in more detail on my next stop.
Is it being used for the Keystone Pipeline argument?
As far as I know, no, not yet. Yeah, that's mostly...
Why would they not?
That's a great question. Yeah. You were just talking about why there's... That's why I'm so excited about this, because there's really nothing stopping us from doing this. I mean, there's a lot of legal hurdles and stuff, I'm sure. But, yeah, that's a great question. There was a case I was going to bring up at the end for my finale, but I could just talk about it now.
It seems so obvious to me. Yeah. As soon as you said that, I was thinking Keystone Pipeline. So, yeah.
What? Curious now. Yeah, is anybody familiar with the Our Children's Trust case going through the federal courts right now? It's the kids' climate change case.
Climate change.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually based in the public trust doctrine. It's one of the first ones to do that.
So I actually had a question about that. That's what I was going to ask about.
Yeah.
Because their argument is that we are, taking the stand about something that's going to happen in the future, and the law tends to operate on you did this therefore, as opposed to you might do this 20 years from now. And so it's like, what effect does that time frame have on the case?
Sure. Yeah, well, actually, and very smartly, their legal team is amazing. They address that by getting, well, first of all, they use kids,
right.
That
will directly impact me in 20 years.
Exactly.
As an adult.
Yeah. And they actually got kids who had asthma and other ailments that can be directly tied to climate change. So they're showing that, in the future it will get worse, and that's what we're worried about. But we have effects right now, right here. This is a person who has a grievance and is being impacted by this now. So they kind of get past that 20 years, 30 years thing with that, hopefully, with that argument. So, yeah. Anybody else have any questions or comments, criticisms?
I have a question, actually. Am I, and perhaps you said it and I missed it, but am I correct in assuming that sort of embedded in this idea of the trust doctrine is this sort of overarching theme of the public good and what that might entail? And I know you mentioned originally that this is sort of a democratic thing, that it's up to, the public to determine what that is, but it does seem like there are a lot of people, I mean, I guess the other stakeholders also have a say in what the public good is as well. Is it just that at present their voice is louder? Or I don't know. I'm not sure if I actually posed a legitimate question.
No, that's, their voices are louder because their pockets are bigger. And I think via Congress and via politics, that's where they're leveraging all this power. And that's why and perhaps this is naive, but the judiciary presents at least some option to get around that, right? Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Yeah. Or,
So basically, so I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part of your question?
I'm not sure if I actually posed a legitimate question.
You've mentioned that it's all related to economic impact. There must be language in there that can also include, when you say public interest, that word interest doesn't necessarily lend itself strictly to an economic impact.
Exactly.
My interest is to be able to hike on Mount Helena every day for the next 40 years. So,
And to breathe clean air and to have a healthy watershed.
And let my children grow to, you know, full height.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's, and there's nothing, because that word is so general and so vague, and in fact the kids in this climate change case are using that very notion of saying what's more fundamental to public interest than a habitable planet. I mean, you can't get any more obvious than that.
So that goes beyond economics.
Yeah, it's the language is what I was getting at, and I think we can, it does go beyond economic for sure. I was just kind of trying to point out that people kind of squirm a little bit.
They focus on that.
Yeah, they focus on it a lot,
well,
especially philosophers.
I think it's the only language that the people with deep pockets speak.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
But and the people with deep pockets could presumably say, you know, there's a public interest in being able to mine this ore and log this forest, and if you stop that, then you're interfering with the public interest.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's obviously a huge problem. It's a huge problem anyway, but what I like about it is and this is very naive, I realize, but it kind of puts the burden back on the public, too. This isn't just telling our government what to do and then they just take care of the problem. I think the idea is more if we recognize, yes, that is a public interest, and all of the copper and the wiring and solar panels and electric vehicles, I mean, there's going to be huge holes in the ground from electrifying our grid. And I think recognizing that up front and recognizing there's a burden on us, too, to change the way we consume and so forth. So. You're right, I don't know. That's my only answer to that huge question, so.
Well, it does make you have to have those conversations.
Yeah.
Which I think right now they're not really happening on a larger scale. Even this is unusual. Look, a dozen of us showed up to talk about it. So I know my kids are interested in it, and they do understand that balance of we want our computers, we want our conveniences, so how do we balance that? I think it has to do with profitability and greed as opposed to actual materials that are necessary.
Mm-hmm. And I have all kinds of fantasies about how we'd fix the mining thing, but I don't
know. Do they involve C4?
No. You know, forcing these corporations to, you know, come up, do materials research and implement like really rigid recycling. You cannot throw any electronic device away that has copper in it. And make them use their profits or a portion of their profits if they want to get these mining permits to develop this technology and implement it. I don't know, something like that.
Plastics manufacturers have to do the same thing.
Yeah. But they do now?
No, they should. Okay. I mean, it's the same for all of those manufacturing materials because there's no commodity in plastic right now, so it's not being recycled because it's cheaper to make new plastic. Brian might know, what was the, I only vaguely know that Coca-Cola company wanted the big plastic bottles because they wanted to get away from having to collect deposits for glass, and they shifted that burden onto the public consuming the Coke because it became plastic instead of glass, which is so much more easily recycled and inert when it's in the ground. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about that?
I don't specifically, but I know it seems to me what they do is they, like the mining company, just defines the economic interest once they get it out of the ground. And so all the externalities, they don't want you to think about that.
Right. Yeah.
So they just, and basically the irony of it, I think, is that they make everybody else, they socialize all the risk
right.
of those things. And they don't want you to think about that
too.
Piece of it. They just want you to think,
yeah.
like you say, oh, I just made money and gave you taxes, but you don't have to think about what I'm going to do to you in 5 years or whatever the case may be. So they're very disingenuous, but that judges buy all that. You have to change people's minds.
Are there any push for kind of life cycle laws where the economic, again, and speaking the economic language they understand, is like, okay, yeah, the cost of making a plastic bottle is 2 cents or whatever it is, but the cost of storing them in a landfill for 7,000 years is X, and so that has to be factored in as well.
Mm. Yeah. Again, they'll shift that burden back to us, though. If they don't take the burden on the research for new materials that are can replace plastic or shift that burden of recycling the plastic into something that's useful, again, it's still but, because they'll just raise the prices. They'll say, well, it's going to cost us, you know, $1,000 in the future, so this is going to cost you more today.
Sure, but I mean, then they're going to be at a disadvantage maybe with somebody who's using glass, and so they'll kind of have to do that research to be forced into it.
I was raised on, you know, trained on television, and when I was about 5-6 years old, we were bombarded with this new word, litter bug, that was not a word before that. And there was a jingle, please, please don't be a litter bug, because every litter bit hurts. And I have an unfortunate mental quirk that I remember jingles.
But, they do that to you on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's exactly brain, why. Like, and I'm one of those people that, you know, just immediately glommed onto that and learned, oh, you don't throw stuff away. But now it's become apparent that behind all of that, trash barrels all of a sudden appearing in places, logos, public information campaigns, propaganda, bottlers and distillers wanting to shift the burden of responsibility for the containers to the public from their industry. And it was really effective.
So just
and
to,
a very, very sneaky.
To play devil's advocate on that, should there not be any responsibility on the consumers?
There should be, you know, and that's the thing, and I appreciate that. That's exactly right, and it made a difference to me. But also at that same time, you know, consumer goods got more packaging. You know, you bought things in bulk more when I was 5 years old, and by the time I was 8, it was already starting to be everything came in a self-contained thing more. And now it's, you know, there's this push and pull between that. And we all know that that's why do you buy stuff in bulk? Well, part of it's to save money, but part of it is because maybe you want to try to not participate in the huge wave of packaging. But that really started to happen in fast food, and so there's all the litter from that. You know, when I was little, hamburgers just came in tissue paper, and then when I was a teenager, they came in styrofoam. Now it's balanced, so they just come in cardboard or maybe a kind of tissue paper again. But the styrofoam's long gone, you know.
You know, there's this one notion I can't get away from when I think about this stuff, is that the only vote you have is your own
pocketbook.
Your own pocketbook, your own personal decision. So there's an enormous burden on each consumer to do the right thing. And and there's so many cases of that where, you know, where somebody creates a new desire. Like I was an interim planner for a while, and one of the my favorite stories there is that, you know, towns like Helena, at one time when I had mass transit, you know, three cars, trolleys, everything else was very efficient and worked well. And so cars came along, and so the rubber companies, the tire companies, the car people started buying up the trolley lines just so they could shut them down.
Right.
And, you know, and it's literally, they in large part made a situation where you had to have a car to get around. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, cars were fun, they were convenient, they were cheap at first. And so they kind of created this need for cars, which now is, you know, just second nature. It's like part of us.
Yeah. And pretty surreptitious while it was happening.
The damage is enormous. And you have to look back at you know, why things got the way they are. You know, why mass transit is such a, you know, kind of left field idea in a town like Helena anymore. But at one time it was, you know, not how to get around out there.
So I wonder if we could look at the positive side of there is not styrofoam at McDonald's anymore. How did we make that happen? Maybe we could look at those case studies. I know it took generations of us fighting it, but what benefits did we get out of it besides not having styrofoam? Well, we have these lessons that we can learn from our demand to not have styrofoam coming out of McDonald's anymore, and the cities that are banning, Missoula bans plastic bags now, mm-hmm. or whatever, straws. So what can we do? And at a local level, because I don't, like you said, it's not going to be the government that's going to help us.
Not voluntarily, yeah.
Yeah. Sort of that ties into Patrick's point about one of the pluses is it puts the burden on society to say, all right, what is something that we would like to see happening? Mm-hmm. So we would like to see styrofoam being banned from fast food restaurants. So a sort of consensus slowly builds and then pressure gets put on people and something changes. But it takes a long time, you know, like 30 years to ban styrofoam in fast food packaging.
So yeah. We have to learn those lessons faster.
Simply yeah. Stop buying things with styrofoam, you know, to choose to buy something else if enough people do it. And so that puts a burden on somebody out there being articulate enough to tell the story of individuals why you shouldn't do that, spread the word. I keep thinking of, you know, what happened to was smoking. When I was in college, kids had ashtrays in the classrooms. I mean, everybody smoked. You walked out of a bar smelling like a, you know, mm-hmm. like a tobacco field. And now, almost nobody smokes, at least not in public. And what happened there? People, for some reason, stopped. And it was a terrible habit for a lot of people, but they stopped nonetheless. And it was a decision thing. So how do we get folks to make this decision? And I think that, mm-hmm. I don't know, that puts a burden, I think, on... people read it, hear it, and say, hey, you know, that's a good idea. I think I'll do that.
I think it's actually easier now. I mean, the whole thing with the straws, I don't know if you guys saw that video that went all over, total viral video of the sea turtle with the straw in her nose, and somebody mm-hmm. taking pliers and pulling mm-hmm. that straw out of her nose so that she could live. That made me... like wake up and go, oh my gosh, I can't, we're not having any more plastic straws in our house. And we live nowhere near the sea turtles. So
right.
I think it's actually easier now than it used to be if you send the right message at the right time and hit the right people in the right picture. And images, video images, yeah. That's the only
way. Visceral.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I guess you don't have to be the big, huge corporation to make the big commercials. Everybody, you know, it has two sides to it, but yeah. Everybody has a mimeograph machine with superpowers now.
You know, there are things that, like recent class and sports cars, you know, the Leopold's working with San Kelly Almanac, you know, just some guy writing stuff down, but for some reason it caught on, it had enormous influence. I was around in college when both those things came out, and it was amazing watching how people's thinking changed, like, conversation changed. And so, I don't know what it will take to deal with climate change, but you know, it's possible there can be revolutionary changes, and starting from